You ever pick up a hitchhiker out on the road? Most of you were probably wiser than I am and don't do that, but I'm kind of a sucker for a hitchhiker from time to time. About half the time I live to regret it, and half the time it's really enlightening and quite interesting. But one time I picked up a hitchhiker that I just couldn't resist. I think you probably would have felt the same. He was a man, a younger man, walking along the road, the highway, with a little boy, and his little boy was carrying a gas can. Now, I just passed the car back a short distance down the road, and you just couldn't help but stop. The car's out there. Here's this man, this little boy. Of course, he made the boy carry the can, you know what I mean? You gotta stop. So I stopped, and I picked him up, and he got in the car, and you know, usually conversation with someone you don't know is rather light, or where you're from, or what you're doing. He was telling me that what they were doing was he had a job in another state, and he was traveling across the country. They were broke. So what he did was he started out with a tank of gas, and they would just drive until they ran out of gas, and then they'd get out the gas can and start walking down the road. He says, sooner or later, somebody stops, helps us. We explain what we're doing, and they help us with gas, and we go back and get the car and put the gas and can of gas in, take the money and go up, fill it up, and we head down the road until we run out of gas, and then we start walking with the can again. And well, after a story like that, I just couldn't help it. I gave him some money for gas because what could I say? I believed that what he said was true. And so he stopped, dropped him at a gas station. He filled his can up, went back to the car, caught a ride the other way, filled it up with the can, filled up the car, and took off again. Well, in the course of driving down the road, again, as I said, sometimes conversation with a hitchhiker could be rather superficial, but he was in the back seat behind me in the van. He says, I'm a Pentecostal. And I thought, well, that's not something the average person would bring up. And I thought, I'm not sure what this conversation's going to be. And sometimes I'm in a good mood and I don't mind talking religion. Other times I'd rather avoid errant conversation. But I figured if I could shut him down, that would be the better part of wisdom that day. And he said, I'm Pentecostal. And I said, I see. That means then you keep the day of Pentecost, right? And it just kind of got quiet in the back seat. He had no connection with those two terms, you know, being Pentecostal and actually keeping Pentecost. I said, well, maybe you need to go study your roots some more. And that kind of ended the religious conversations. He didn't want to bring anything else up after that. Now, Pentecost to us is such a familiar term. You know, if you and I were discussing Pentecost, or if I asked you about it or what it meant, you'd have a ready answer. It wouldn't be foreign to you. You might say, well, that's when the law was given. Or you might say, well, indeed, the Holy Spirit was given in the New Testament. And the New Testament church began 31 A.D. You might talk about God's plan of salvation. I mean, you'd probably have a lot you could mention and say about the day of Pentecost. If I asked you what the name itself means, who knows what the name Pentecost means, the name itself? Anybody? Nobody. Everybody knows, right? Count 50, 50. So if I brought that up, you'd bring back very, very quickly. Penta in Greek is 5. All right. Why then the number 50, and why do we count it? You go to the text, the account in Leviticus 23, it says you count. We don't count to Passover in that sense. I mean, you take the sacrifice, and it's out for certain days, the lamb when it was given. But you know, we don't count to trumpets. We don't count to atonement. We don't count to the Feast of Tabernacles, do we? No, God just says, well, it's a particular month and a particular day, and that's when you keep it, and just show up, and I'll be there, so to speak. And Pentecost is different. It says to count to Pentecost. So why do we count to Pentecost? I think that's something that probably we haven't stopped and answered in the same way that we understand what the technical meaning is. Why didn't God just give us a specific day and a month and be done? Make life simple. Today is the 50th day, counting from the lifting up of the wave sheaf on the day after the Sabbath in the midst of the days of unleavened bread. Perry Miller was describing here his friend that he met and how they count differently and how they began to have discussion on these matters. The word Pentecost, when we say 50th or count 50, is a reference to the amount of time that has passed from that lifting of the wave sheaf and to the position that we have now arrived. It's a reference to the whole period of time and the fact that we have arrived at the end of that time as we keep this day. Now, to more fully understand the meaning of Pentecost, therefore I believe we have to more fully understand both why we count to 50 and in fact what 50 really represents. Leviticus 23, basic chapter, but let me show you something here if I may. Verse number 5 addresses the Passover. God in this chapter gives proportionate instruction based on the message that he wants to portray. Now, you can read about the Passover somewhere else, and you can read about the other holy days somewhere else, but here, by comparison, he simply has a single verse of the Passover, and it says that's the instruction that we have. When you go on in verse number 6 through verse number 8, in regard to the days of unleavened bread, you have three verses describing the days of unleavened bread, and in those three verses, there's even instruction in regard to the offerings that are there given. Go down to verse number 23, and we're talking about the feast here of trumpets. Three verses, 23, 24, 25, cover the feast of trumpets. One verse for Passover, three verses for the days of unleavened bread, three verses for the feast of trumpets. Goes on to atonement, verse number 26. Atonement's more extensive. God has something different in atonement that's different than the other days. And so he reminds us, gives us a specific lesson. 26 through 32, seven verses now cover atonement. God says essentially the same thing three times. He says, afflict yourselves, which we understand is to fast, and don't work. He says, afflict yourselves, and don't work. And in case we get used to the message, he says, don't work and afflict yourself. The last time, he just kind of reverses it around. Seven verses to say the same thing three times so that we won't miss the point. Now, if you add up all the verses for atonement, for trumpets, for the days of unleavened bread, and for Passover, and you put them together, that's the number of verses, essentially, you have when it explains how to keep Pentecost. Strange to me when I first looked at that and began to realize that there was something that God was trying to show us with Pentecost that was different or in addition to the other days that was done in such a way that it took a little more instruction even in a very condensed offering or a very condensed chapter such as this is. The verses in regard to Pentecost start in verse number 9 and end in verse number 21. And after verse 21, there's even an additional verse, 22, that explains a related principle that I'll address with you later. Again, what stuck out to me as I was studying this is the emphasis in this passage on the process of counting to Pentecost. The fact is, we look on our calendar, see when it is, and we simply show up. And yet the large passage we have here talks about counting and the importance of the numbering itself. Verse number 9, let me read through some of this with you. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses and said, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you and you reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. And he will wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. So there was actually a sheaf of grain cut, and the grain was lifted up to God, portraying Jesus Christ being lifted up to heaven. And that portrayed the first of the first fruits lifted up to God, and a harvest now began to take place. Verse number 15, and you shall count to yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. Now, if you and I were to count to 50, how would we do it? 1, 2, 3, 4. One time I was driving around with Derek in the car, and Derek is learning to count, and he's real excited about it. And in the course of the errands, he counted to 1,000. Drove me nuts, but he counted to 1,000. And then we weren't quite home yet, and he said, would you like me to count to 2,000? And I said, no, I would like you to rest now. If we were to count to 50, we would just count with 1, 2, 3, we'd count right to 50. The instruction here, though, is different than that. The instruction says that we will count by Sabbaths. Seven Sabbaths shall be complete. Count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath, and then you will offer a new grain offering to the Lord. So this is different, and it's important on the way this is counted. Counting this is part of understanding the symbolism of Pentecost itself. So you count 7, 14, 21, 28. You count by weeks, and then when you get to the end of your 49, you add one more day, and that additional day stands by itself in the count and is important, very important as well. Verse number 21. And you shall proclaim on the same day that it is a holy convocation to you. You shall do no customary work on it. It will be a statue forever in all your dwellings throughout your generations. So again, we count to 50 in a very particular and special way. And as Perry mentioned, I think he mentioned Shavuot, but the feast of Pentecost was actually called in the Old Testament the Feast of Weeks. Not the feast of 1 to 50, not the feast of the 50th, the Feast of Weeks, because you count in Sabbaths. And again, that's significant. Leviticus 23, verse number 15, says, you shall count yourselves from the day after the Sabbath. The Hebrew word here for count means to score with a mark or a tally or a record or to add something up. In another context, it also means to declare or to speak out. My point being this, counting is an act. It's something that is actively done. It is not just a thought or a concept. The meanings of the word imply that something specific is done to record or to speak out or to give evidence to. So there's a process here that then takes place. The actual counting to Pentecost is part of the symbolism of the feast. Now, when a person is counting to a particular point, it usually means that their attention is focused on that point. We have Derek back there, in his best church form, is drawing one of the space shuttle rockets. You have a countdown, and they count in reverse, and you count down to zero, and then the shuttle takes off. You're focused on the takeoff, but you count down to that point. So there's a process of anticipation of getting to that point. If a woman is pregnant with a child, all you have to ask, if you want to know when that child would be born, is how long left until your child is born. Because the first thing we do is we try to estimate the date on the other end when we're first pregnant and see when that will be. And then as we go through the pregnancy, we begin to count off the weeks and the months. And if you get down, as I remember, to that last month, and that baby is hanging out way out here, and your back is hurting, and everything else is beginning to give a little as well. I mean, then we start saying, yes, only 14 more days, only another week. And we count right down, and we anticipate that baby being delivered. If you're a senior in high school or a senior in college and you're approaching graduation, don't we stop and say, okay, I got a week, I've got 3 weeks, I got a month, I've got 12 days, and we start to work our way back down, whatever the timing would be. One young man that Michelle and I knew in the church, his bride-to-be wanted to make a very special memento and have him really focus on the wedding, and so she gave him a small amount of jelly beans. And she gave him enough jelly beans so that he'd have one jelly bean for each day up until the wedding, and then the last jelly bean he would give back to her at the wedding day itself. So every day he ate one of these jelly beans, counted what was left, right down, the last jelly bean was the day of their wedding, he gave it back to her, and then they went and had their stomachs pumped. But it was a way to focus. We do that in different ways indeed when we count. Now, the Church of God does not have a doctrine that states that unless you count to Pentecost, you won't fully be keeping the feast. So that is not my point today. The priests in the Bible times were the ones who maintained the calendar. But I do believe, indeed, that it will help us to understand the significance of the counting and the symbolism of the day itself just the same, if we could put those concepts together. Leviticus 25 is important in this regard. Notice what the meaning here, and then apply it to the way the count is made. Leviticus 25 says, and the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruit. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. The seventh year is a Sabbath year. It is a year of rest, and it is a year that is dedicated here to the Lord, to God. It's dedicated to God in a special way. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. It was a year of rest. Do you notice again, going back, we count to Pentecost in weeks, in chunks. Now here we have a sabbatical year that comes along every Sabbath week as such. Every 7 years, this takes place. Verse number 5. How this was administered. What grows of its own accord Of your harvest you shall not reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it's a year of rest for the land. God says, don't go out there and build this up in your barns. Don't go out there and harvest a crop for sale. You can go ahead and simply live off of the produce that is there and look to God for me to provide. I'm going to bless you and the land as well with rest. And the Sabbath produce of the land shall be food for you and your servant, for your maidservant and your hired servant, for the stranger who sojourns with you, for your livestock and the animals that are in your land. All of its produce shall be for food. Now, if we stop and look at that, the seventh year, a sabbatical year, Deuteronomy describes what the meaning of that year is and what some of the things were that would then take place. Deuteronomy 15 and verse 1. The same sabbatical year is described. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. So we have the circumstance here where now this sabbatical year is a year of release. The debts are free. The land rests. The cash debts that were out in the economy at that time were supposed to be forgiven, and the economy was adjusted accordingly in advance. Deuteronomy 31, another account on this sabbatical year and how the year effectively was intended to take place. Deuteronomy 31, verse number 9. Says, so Moses wrote this law, delivered it to the priests. So it's just showing that there was a recording of the law of God, that Moses gave that to the priests, the sons of Levi, who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, same period of time, cash debts are released, land is resting, the people are resting, at the appointed time in the year of release at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and little ones, and a stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear and that they may learn to fear the Lord your God and carefully observe all the words of this law, and that their children who have not known it may hear and learn and fear the Lord your God as long as you live in the land which you crossed the Jordan to possess. Isn't that incredible? Here was a year when you didn't have to work the same way you worked in other years, that it was a year of release. And you didn't have some of the debts that remained, because those were washed out of the system as well. And you didn't have to plant and harvest, because that wasn't part of it. God said he would provide. And you could simply live off of the abundance of the land that remained, and you could use your time for something else. And God says, one of the things you should use your time for is to focus on your relationship with me. So we have this Sabbath counting now taking place. Don't you think that you'd be looking forward to that kind of a Sabbath? I can imagine that we all would. And you'd be counting down. How many years left, honey? 7? Oh, you mean last year we just had 6 years, 5 years, and then we got this break. And we have this great opportunity. Time to catch up around the house. Time to be with our family. Time to do some things we couldn't do before. Time to spend time getting closer to God in a way that you can't do all the time when you're busy, when demands are put on you, when you're struggling simply to make ends meet. And God said he would provide for his people in a way that those things could be accomplished. So in the seventh year, the land rested, you rested, debts were cleared, and more time was spent with your family and with God. That took place after 2 third-tithe cycles. Third tithe is given in the third year and in the sixth year of a seven-year cycle. Then the seventh year becomes a year of release. And God planned that as a blessing for his people. Now notice, back in Leviticus 25, if we go back there, in verse number 8, we're now addressing the year of Jubilee, because God said to count in Sabbaths to the Pentecost, and the Sabbath was signifying the sabbatical years, and so we're talking about a building of freedom, a building of prosperity, a building of blessing from God that we recognize as an ongoing symbol that would go through our lives. Now we have verse number 8. You shall count 7 Sabbaths of years, 7 Sabbaths of sabbatical years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. This is how you count to Pentecost as well. says, then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land for all its inhabitants. It will be a Jubilee for you. And each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. That 50th year shall be a Jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of the untended vine, for it is a Jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his own possession. All the land in the 50th year that had been sold out was returned to the original owners. Everybody in Israel got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to start over, to start again, with no debt, with their land returned, where they could go back and occupy the home maybe of their youth, maybe drought, maybe other problems, maybe bad management, maybe hard luck had caused you for some reason to lose your property and lose your money and your resource. And God says, once in your life, I'm going to set you free from the bondage of not being able to produce and care for yourself, and I will let you start again. Do you think you'd count down to that? You think you'd be looking at that land very longingly and wishing you could be back on it and planting your crops again and providing for your family again? You think you'd be counting down to 50 saying, yes, only two more years. Yes, one more year and I'm home free. I think we would be. That's the symbolism of Pentecost. We count to Pentecost in groups of seven, the Sabbath, sabbatical years. And then finally, after seven of those, we add the year which is the Jubilee year symbolically. And we're free. We're home, and we're returned in that sense to God and to each other as well. Imagine all the farmers who've lost their land over the last 50 years. Imagine if they could all get it back, free and clear, and have it and use it and pass it on to their children. I lived on a ranch before I went to college. I was working on a project that was under Len here, who's visiting us. During the week, I worked under Len, quite a ways under him. In fact, all the way under him. And on Friday nights, I'd go over to the house, and Gloria would fix up a meal, and we'd have a Sabbath dinner. And it was really a delightful time. I remember those days very fondly. And in the evening, Gloria and I'd pour us a glass of wine, sit out on the patio, and we'd talk about the church till 2 a.m. and solve all the world's problems. But it was a wonderful time. But I lived on a ranch back then during the week. The man who had that ranch had about 8 or 9 sections of land. It was in New Mexico. Some of the land was leased and some of it was privately owned by him. His father had a ranch that was right next to his, to the north. And his father had about 12 sections. And so it was a wonderful place. You could take a horse out and ride up and down through the hills and the valley areas there. And there was cactus and grass and water in some spots. There was a place where you could ride your motorcycle up and down. Across the highway and down a little bit was a large mountain, kind of a wilderness area with bighorn sheep on it and cliffs and caves and Indian artifacts laying around the dirt if you wanted to scrape around and find them. It was a nice place for that time in my life. This man's father that had the ranch on the north side had actually come from Lubbock, Texas. I was surprised when I arrived in Lubbock on the other end, having heard that name. He was a ranch hand on the XIT ranch. The jokes about Texas and everything being big, they're not all jokes. There are some things down there that were quite large. The XIT ranch meant 10 in Texas. And what it was it was a ranch that was 10 counties wide, big. 2 counties wide, 5 counties tall, normal-sized counties, and that was the ranch, 10 counties. And they called it 10 in Texas XIT. He was a ranch hand on the XIT, decided to strike out on his own and homestead out there in New Mexico, and he got a wagon in Lubbock, and he headed out with his possessions, and he set up stake out there and started his property and his ranch. And then when his son was born and came along and grew up next to his dad, he acquired property right neighboring to his dad, and so it was a place that they wanted to stay and live and pass on to their children. It was something that was very meaningful and important to them. Said that old wagon that he drove across that land was still sitting out in his front yard down there with a little bit of moisture they have and the dry air. It just sat there, and I suppose quite a few pieces of it are still there to this day. They both built their homes out there in that country and built them bit by bit, a few rooms at a time. They were Spartan. They weren't especially fancy. The mantles of the fireplaces were decorated with the arrowheads and the Indian artifacts that they found along the lakeside shore that had once been there. They knew each other. They knew the neighbors. They knew anyone who lived up and down that valley pretty much. I think they probably knew every cactus as well. One day, John says, "Mark, come with me. I want to show you something. It's very special to me, and I don't show this to many. It was something important. We had made a friendship, and he said, I want to show you something." He took me up in the hills behind the house, and we walked for quite a ways, and we got into this little draw where rocks rose up on both sides, and right in the middle of the draw was grass, and from that draw, you could look down into the valley floor, and shortly behind it, you could look across the ridge and back down the other side. He says, Billy was his wife, he said, "Billy and I want to build a house here someday." He says, "This is where we really want our home." He said, "We built down there where the corrals could be placed, and we built where we had a place to drill for the water and bring in the cattle," he said, "but this is where ultimately we want to build our home and to live." Last time I saw him, he was working at a cattle auction in the nearest town, driving truck part of the time, making saddles, belts, whatever he could do to make a living. Price for cattle just wasn't sufficient in those circumstances for him to make it work out there. He piled up some debt, and they had to move off of the land and go to work. Last time I saw him, I said, "Do you still have the land?" He says, "Yes, I still retain control." But he was really struggling, and again, to make the money, to make the payments, to lease out what was left, and to hold on to that which he privately owned. I think a man like that would appreciate the Jubilee. I think a man like that would like to see sabbatical years roll around. You think he would anticipate counting to 7? You think he would anticipate counting to 49 and then finally 50? Because he knew the debt would be cleared, the cash would be off of him, then he knew the land would be returned, and he knew that if he needed to, he could go back there and live again, or he could pass it on to his child or his grandchild. You think there'd be anticipation and excitement as those years rolled around? That's what Pentecost symbolizes. That's what the symbolism of the sabbatical and the Jubilee is, that we are returned to freedom, that we are removed from bondage, that we are restored to each other and to God. And God says, "I will give you the time, I will give you the abundance, and I will give you the freedom to return to me and to be blessed physically as well." It's incredible. Even if this man would have died before the Jubilee rolled around again, that land would still have been then restored to his children, no matter what. I guess that would give us all a little more comfort, even in our own death, to know that there was something, no matter what, would still be passed on. We had a family farm in North Dakota once. It was lost, not by my father, but by his father. It was gambled away. It was thrown away. But it can never be restored. We have no Jubilee. We don't have sabbaticals anymore. There's no way to get that land back. It's going to be different someday when all the world begins to keep the Jubilee. But it ought to be something that we have a taste of now in a spiritual way, in a way that God deals with us as we keep this day of Pentecost. Notice something else in Leviticus 25. Verse 39, "If one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. But as a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of the Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, both he and his children with him, and shall return to his own family. He shall return to the possession of his fathers." Remember what it said on the other passages? It said you will return to your land and to your family. It means if you were sold into bondage, into servitude, that you would be free as well. You would be free to return. "For they are my servants," God says, "whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over him with rigor, but you shall fear your God." God says, indeed, when you release that man, according to his Jubilee, when you release him from the bondage that he is held under, you're releasing him back to God because he is ultimately God's servant. And you're returning him to the land in that sense that God gave him and to the conditions in which he started. Remember, verse number 4, sabbatical year was a Sabbath to the Lord. It was in honor of the Lord. Moffat translation says it was in honor of God. And so the sabbatical years and the jubilee years were years in which, by obeying God, by serving God, He blesses us, but it's a way that we were able to give honor to God as well because of the great blessing in the system that He had set up. Remember in Matthew 5:25, Christ said, "Inasmuch as you did it unto the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me." As we release people from the bondage in which we hold them to, as we release them from the debts in which they have to us, God says, in that sense, as they're His people, we release them back to God. We set them free. God wants His people to be free. He wants us to be free. He wants us to understand the symbolism of that. Not just physically, but spiritually. A man who had been sold for his debts and was working for someone as their servant was like a man waiting to be released from prison. We've all seen the calendars of the books or seen the movies where this prisoner has on the wall a calendar. And every day you check off one more day and there's a release date maybe on there. And it's so long until parole. It's so long until we're released. And you check every day because you're waiting. And you anticipate the time when you walk out the door. That's why we count to Pentecost. The symbolism of the day is the symbolism of counting to freedom. Counting by Sabbaths, sabbatical years, counting to the Jubilee, when we can be restored to our land, to our people, to our family, but ultimately, obviously, restored to God. We don't live in a system where these rules fully apply, but the spiritual principles apply, and they always have. I left one of my props in Kennewick. I knew if I went back to get it, I would really be late. When I was in the Army, they had a system of counting to the time that you would get out. Nowhere in my life have I ever been in a situation where so many people wanted to get out as was the Army. They called them short-timers. And there was a drawing. All of the artists in the Army would draw pictures of being a short-timer. And I had this steel pot I was going to try to show you with the lining removed. But again, I left it back there in Kennewick. But what they would do is, as you're getting close to the time you'd get out of the Army, you'd call yourself, or the military, but the Army is the only experience I have, a short-timer. And they'd draw a picture of a man with a steel pot on his head, and a steel pot would come down to like here. And you couldn't see the top of his head. And the concept was that this man is shorter than he was before. And then you'd see another picture a little later, and the steel pot would be on his shoulders. He's getting shorter and shorter. And the shorter you are, the closer you are to leaving. Short timer, and that was the concept. And so everyone drew pictures of this as they were getting ready to leave. And then finally, at the very end, you would see a picture, and sometimes they would do this. They would take their boots and set their boots out and set their steel pot on their boots so that just the toes stuck out. And that meant the next couple of days, you were out of there. You were very, very close. And so it was something that was unique to that circumstance, but it was a way of counting down to freedom. Counting down to release. And so it's just, again, it's symbolic of the way God counted to Pentecost and what Pentecost actually symbolizes. One of the reference works I use is the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. So I looked up in it the Jubilee year, and I want to read you part of what it says. It says, according to Leviticus, a loud trumpet should proclaim liberty throughout the country on the 10th day of the 7th month, the Day of Atonement, after the lapse of 7 Sabbaths of years, or 49 years. In this manner, every 50th year was to be announced as a Jubilee year. All real property should automatically revert to its original owner, and those who, compelled by poverty, had sold themselves as slaves to their brothers should regain their liberty. In addition to this, the Jubilee year was to be observed after the manner of the sabbatical year. For instance, there should be neither sowing, nor reaping, nor pruning of vines. Everyone was expected to live on what the fields and the vineyards produced of themselves, and no attempt should be made at storing up the products of the land. Thus, there are 3 distinct factors constituting the essential features of the Jubilee year. 1, personal liberty. 2, restitution of property, economic liberty. And 3, which is the one I like, it says what we might call the simple life. I mean, how would you like to have the simple life? I mean, we're so busy. We struggle in that sense when we make our livings. We have so many obligations and commitments in this society. It seems to build and build and build. And yet, what God built in, personal liberty, economic freedom, and times when we could have the simple life. There would be actually one time in your life when you would have 2 years where God would simply give you what you needed from the produce of the land that you did not have to reap or sow, and that you would have time to focus on God and focus on family and do those things which could not otherwise be done. I think we'd all look forward to that. I think we'd count down to it. Even the Levites, in their personal responsibilities, were given a release from heavy duties at the age of 50. Now, because the Levites were born on an ongoing basis, it didn't coincide with the Jubilee. Imagine yourself, a Levite, they had heavy work to do. They're hauling in these big beef. They cut them up, they burn them, they do all these things, and they haul out the ashes and clean up the temple. That was hard physical work. They carried around the ark on their shoulders, and they did all these things. And they hauled this temple on the tabernacle on their backs. Well, about the time you're getting to be about 45 and you're hauling this tabernacle on your back and your bunions are acting up and your back hurts and you're cranky and tired and you're saying, boy, I tell you what, I can't wait till I'm 50 to let some of these young bucks take over and do this work, and then I'm going to move into the office. I'm going to go back where there's an air conditioner and, you know, fans are blowing and have a little easier life. You'd be counting down. It's like looking toward maybe a retirement or an opportunity to do something different. The Levites were released from their heavy duties at the age of 50 as well. It was a type of freedom. It was a blessing. It was a release. Leviticus 25, verse 44. There's a catch here, though. And it's an interesting catch. It says, as for your male and female slaves whom you have, from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy male and female slaves. Now, I don't always know why God did the things He did the way He did. I mean, obviously there were times when men had 5, 6 wives, and somebody must have thought that was a blessing, but, you know, didn't always work out real well, but it was something that God tended to allow, and these things were corrected, and obviously in the New Testament there were different rules and regulations for God's people, but in this case, they were allowed to have slaves. In that context, of course. It says, moreover, you may buy the children of the strangers who sojourn among you, and their families who are with you, which they beget in your land, and they shall become your property. And you shall take them as an inheritance for your children after you, to inherit them as a possession, they shall be your permanent slaves. Now understand, the Hebrew could not be a permanent slave against his will. He could not be forced to remain in that circumstance. But God says those indeed, in this case, who were not His people, didn't have the same blessings and options that His people did. But regarding your brethren, the children of Israel, you shall not rule over one another with rigor. And so there was an opportunity for His people always to have a chance for freedom that everyone else did not have. They didn't have the same option. True freedom was only available to God's own people. What nation is called the land of the free today? You know, freedom is mentioned very prominently in our national anthem. It's in our history. People came to this place, this nation, to have freedom of religion, freedom of belief, freedom from persecution, freedom from famine. They came here, indeed, to be free as a slave, and freed from slave, I mean. I mean, it's part of our history and it's part of our culture. Not that it has been perfectly done, but it is very much there, part of the concepts that we all have in our minds. I think it's interesting that the United States now has 50 states. Now, I can't prove anything by that, but I don't think it's an accident either. I don't think it's an accident that a nation that was founded and based on freedom, however imperfect that concept was, grew to be a nation before God that has 50 states in that sense, almost as it represents that Jubilee. When we count to 50 on Pentecost, we're counting to freedom. With the Holy Spirit, we can be free from spiritual ignorance, hopelessness, but more importantly, we can also be free from sin. And that's true freedom indeed. Unfortunately, there is no record in the Bible that Israel ever did keep the sabbatical years and the Jubilee years as God had intended for them to. Israel apparently never did really experience either true freedom or true rest, and neither does our nation today. Look at Luke chapter 4. Luke 4, verse 14. Christ had been tempted out in the desert. He begins to preach now the gospel of the kingdom of God. notice what he refers to as he begins to teach people about the kingdom. Then Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and the news of him went throughout all the surrounding region. And he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. And so he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah, and when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." This is the introduction to the message of the gospel that he is about to preach. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives." When were the captives delivered? They were delivered on the Jubilee. "And recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." It is a very clear and specific reference to the Jubilee and to the freedom that was obtained in that process. Christ came to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God, and he was preaching freedom to those who were bound in bondage, freedom to those who were oppressed. Christ came in that sense. The message of his gospel was a jubilee for the people of God that God would then call. Matthew 11, another account in regard to Christ's ministry, and verse number 28, Christ says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Typifying his ministry. Typifying the sabbatical rest, the jubilee rest, the freedom, the release from bondage and labor. "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest in your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Pentecost should portray to us this true rest and this true freedom. The symbolism of the spring harvest, because of the way Pentecost is counted, is intimately related to the symbolism of counting as well. The Jews read the book of Ruth on Pentecost. I think when we read that book and study it, as we sometimes do during the spring season, we think of the marriage of Christ and the church and the symbolism in that respect. The setting is Ruth and Naomi, though, returning to Israel at the beginning of the harvest season. The barley harvest started with the wave sheaf offering during the days of unleavened bread. Lifted up to God, that first sheaf was cut, the grain was lifted up, and then the barley harvest began. The wheat harvest followed about 3 weeks later and ended around Pentecost. The whole spring harvest, not just Pentecost itself, but the whole spring harvest pictures those who were first called to salvation in the plan of God. The first of the first fruit is the sheaf that is cut that represents Jesus Christ. But all the spring harvest is first fruit. All of that process to Pentecost pictures those who were called first to salvation in the plan of God. Counting to 50 is counting to the completion of the harvest. How was it that Ruth survived during that time out in the fields? She gleaned in the fields. Remember, we were in Leviticus 23, and we were going through the outline there on the holy days, and there was one particular verse, number 22, which I said was related, but it was added on, and it seems almost out of character. But look at this. Leviticus 23, verse 22. "When you reap the harvest of your land," this is in regard to Pentecost, "you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field when you reap, nor shall you gather any gleaning from your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God." The whole harvest season in the spring was part of the Pentecost symbolism. And therefore, the gleaning and the providing, the provision made for the poor to release their bondage so that they would have economic opportunity, so that they could eat, so that they could live as well, was part of that freedom, part of that symbolism that was built in. Deuteronomy 24 talks about gleaning, ties it into freedom from bondage, which is what is being symbolized here. Deuteronomy 24, verse number 19. "Therefore it shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around, in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out." What have I done here? Deuteronomy 24. I've moved over to chapter 25. I'm sorry. I have to go back. Chapter 24, verse 19. "When you reap your harvest in the field, and forget a sheaf in the field, You shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, I never have beat an olive tree, I've beat my kids, but it says, when you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And you shall remember, and here's the lesson in the context, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. You shall remember that you were in bondage, and therefore there are people around you in bondage, and you shall make provision for them as well. It doesn't say go out and harvest it and hand it to them so that they can sit and eat at your expense. It says give them opportunity to provide for themselves. Give them a chance. Give them a chance to make their own way. That's what God's intent would be. Again, from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, this time on the article Pentecost. It says it signified the completion of the barley harvest, which had begun at the time of the waving of the first ripe sheaf of the first fruits. Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, therefore fell on the 50th day after this occurrence. The wheat was then also nearly everywhere harvested, and the general character of the festival was that of a harvest home celebration. There was a Thanksgiving-style celebration on Pentecost. It was a harvest festival. The day was observed as a Sabbath day. All labor was suspended, and the people appeared before God to express their gratitude. It was a festival of good cheer, a day of joy. Free will offerings were made to the Lord, and it was to be marked by a liberal spirit toward the Levite, the stranger, the orphans, and the widow. Why? Because the day symbolizes freedom. It symbolizes release from bondage. The Israelites were admonished to remember their bondage on that day and to reconsecrate themselves to the Lord. I think it's interesting. Some of you here are farmers. Crop's not guaranteed till the harvest is complete, is it? As long as that crop is out in the field, then there's a chance that maybe it will rain and it will be good in nourishment, but maybe it won't and it will be dry. Maybe that same storm that brings the nourishing rain will bring hail. And we've probably all seen a field after the hail has destroyed it and little stubby, sharp stalks are standing up where all of this grain has been shattered. Until that harvest is in the barn, it's not a guarantee. And so the farmer begins to count the days until the harvest, begins to look at the beauty and the potential that is out there and begin to realize just 30 more days and I'll bring that crop in. 2 more weeks, I'll bring that crop in. Begins to count down to freedom. Begins to count down to the time when the harvest is secure. That's what Pentecost pictures. That's why we count. That's what the symbolism of the Sabbath, again, in the Jubilee is there. Look what happened without the Jubilee. Now, you read history and I read history, and what you've read is probably different than what I have, but some of what I've read indicates that there has been a major economic crisis, at least since the 1700s to our time, every 50 years. Now, I don't know if there was even an economy before the 1700s, but from what I've seen, there was a major economic crisis in the 1780s. What do you think it led to the rise of? What happened in the late 1700s and the very early 1800s? The rise of Napoleon. It was an economic failure that led, indeed, if you go back and read through historically, to the rise of Napoleon at that time. Now, there were economic failures, again, major failures, fundamental failures in the 1830s and the 1880s. The Depression of the 1930s was, again, on that very same cycle. What did the Depression of the 1930s lead to? The rise of Adolf Hitler. Go back and read your history on that point. The conditions in Germany and such that took place and how he was able to take advantage of that and how the people cried out for someone to take charge and those desperate times led to the rise of Adolf Hitler. Now, the world has paid a horrible, terrible price for not being able to serve God and be under his system and under his rule, choosing their own way. In our time, we appear to have, at least for a time, managed to avoid the downside of that same cycle. A cycle that would have fallen in the 80s does not appear to have carried through, at least to this day. I don't know what the circumstance of that ultimately is going to be, but we have ignored the solution to the problem that has been portrayed to us by God. A solution of freedom, a solution of economic responsibility, but also economic freedom as well. What we call freedom today, what is freedom to this country and to this nation, is not really freedom at all. It's actually bondage in God's eyes. True freedom is freedom from sin, not freedom to sin. What we have been taught in this country is not freedom indeed. By counting to Pentecost, we anticipate more and more both true freedom and true rest, first for the first fruits, and then ultimately for all of mankind. And when Pentecost finally arrives, it's like having the spring harvest safely in the barn, a harvest that was only made possible by the power of God's Holy Spirit. It portrays the completion of a great task and also the beginning of our new life in that sense to come. Pentecost pictures freedom in its fullest sense because it's freedom from sin. Through Jesus Christ, we have access to that Spirit by which power God restores us to freedom and restores us to Himself. So we can stop counting now. The Feast of Pentecost is here. Our freedom has arrived.